From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Democrats wrestle with how to respond to the harassment allegations against longtime Congressman John Conyers.
The Democrats are facing a very important election in 2018 and do not want to be in the position of seeing as if they're enabling someone who is accused of this sort of behavior.
We have to have a really honest conversation in this country about what is offensive behavior and what behavior crosses the line.
A Michigan Teacher of the Year calls for new ways to teach our kids.
There is a national crisis. We are really in trouble. Even teachers don't want their kids to be teachers.
Sports commentator John Eubacon on MSU.
You're taking 2- and 3-star players and you're beating 4- and 5-star players. And hats off.
And Michigan.
Everything here is structurally sound.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He denies the accusations that he has harassed women through the years. But Democratic Congressman John Conyers said Sunday he will step down as ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler is with us now. Todd, give us a sense of how important this position is.
You know, it's the House, so the Republicans are in charge. It's not like Congressman Conyers or the ranking member on Judiciary or any committee can make laws happen by themselves. They can. But what they can do is have a great role in helping to shape that legislation in terms of getting certain witnesses before the committee. They also, because they're the ranking member, have more of a role to play in terms of getting bills that Democrats want to consider, for instance, before the committee. So there is definitely a certain amount of power that goes along with it. Nothing like being chairman. I mean, being chairman is a much bigger deal.
What about the symbolism?
Oh, I mean, symbolically for Conyers and really for the Congressional Black Caucus, it's a huge deal for him to step down. I mean, he's the first African-American to sit in that role in the Judiciary Committee, first African-American chairman previously of the committee. And you can tell that from his statement that he's going to step down, that this is not something that Conyers wanted to do. You know, he's a legendary civil rights figure. Nancy Pelosi had it right when she said that yesterday. And he's not going to go easily on that sort of stuff. This is really hard for him.
And is this doing anything to quell the calls for John Conyers to resign from Congress?
I think it will. Yeah, I think there will still be plenty of people who say he needs to go. But I think that his stepping down as the Democratic face of the Judiciary Committee will allow him to sort of fade in the background somewhat while this ethic investigation goes on. And that might take months. I mean, there's no real idea how long that will take. It won't be quick, I wouldn't think. And that will take some of the heat off him. I believe there's some people will still continue to ask him to resign, but that will cool down somewhat unless there are more allegations.
Okay, and that's just to be determined. I mean, that's going to take on its old life as this unfolds.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we don't have any reason to believe that there's any other people who are going to come out regarding Conyers, but we've already seen several, and so you never know.
What are you hearing, Todd, from Michigan's congressional delegation about this? First, with the Republicans.
You know, the Republicans have largely been quiet on this. I know that a couple members, Bill Heisinger from out in West Michigan, for instance, has said that Conyers should resign if the allegations are true. I think that's more of what you're hearing from folks, that, you know, if it turns out that this really did happen, then he should go. And it's true of the Republicans and the Democrats, really, if they're saying that thing. The Democrats, I think, are more pointedly feel like they have to make some sort of response regarding these allegations. And they're the ones in Michigan who are saying there needs to be an investigation, a full vetting of these accusations to see what really happened.
Considering, as you pointed out, John Conyers' role in American civil rights history, this has got to be a very delicate dance for Democrats in particular.
Certainly. Both with this and with the allegations involving Senator Franken from Minnesota, the Democrats certainly do not want to be seen as helping or supporting someone who's accused of these sorts of activities or behaviors. At the same time, and with the case of Conyers particularly, you have someone who's been a legend in their party and in the civil rights movement for decades. You don't want to push him out. You don't want to necessarily alienate the Congressional Black Caucus, which is easily one of the most powerful caucuses in Congress, by seeming to too quickly push him aside. So that is a very delicate dance. On the other hand, the Democrats are facing a very important election in 2018 and do not want to be in the position of seeing as if they're enabling someone who is accused of this sort of behavior.
In your view, Todd, what kind of moment in congressional history is unfolding here? I mean, where could this take American politics and take Congress?
Well, I think that what could happen here, you know, and I think it would be to the better, is for more transparency on the Hill regarding sexual harassment and just bad behavior. For years, you hear this thing or that thing about what's going on up on the Hill, and it's always done in the dark. You never really hear about it. That's not to say that people haven't been pushed out because of sexual misconduct. They have. I mean, Packwood from way back comes to mind. But that being said, there's been way more concerns of things happening, and this seems to, this along with the Weinstein and Kevin Spacey issues and Louis C.K. and et cetera, seems to be bringing us to a point where in Congress, maybe, we will end up with a better system for accusers to be able to go after these folks and have something really done about it.
Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler. As always, Todd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell is with us now. Congresswoman, these accusations against John Conyers and his admission that he settled this $27,000 claim with one woman using office funds, taxpayer dollars, how does all of this square with the man that you've known for so long?
You know, this is all very complicated. And I think we're having a really complicated discussion in this country. I'm going to take this from different perspectives because I think women of, I'm not old, but I'm seasoned. And women of my generation, unfortunately, have too many stories. And there have been men that we have all known that have done good things for people, but have also been very responsible or have been guilty of sexual harassment. Every person in this country is innocent until proven guilty. But we're at a time in our country, the question is this really going to be a watershed moment? And so we have to have a really honest conversation in this country about what is offensive behavior and what behavior crosses the line. And are we going to move to a point that behavior that crosses the line is zero tolerance or not? So it's complicated. Congressman Conyers is where it belongs in the Ethics Committee for a full and complete investigation. It needs to happen very quickly. It cannot just sit there. We need to get the facts. But I think we're all struggling in this country with how we deal with complicated issues like this. But I will tell you, there are too many women I've known that have been labeled troublemakers, suffered consequences. And it is this the moment where someone who has been victimized is no longer the victim, but that we're having open and honest and true conversations.
Well, you know, and it is complicated. I'm thinking now of the social media backlash against Nancy Pelosi after she was on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. When she was asked about the complaints against Congressman Conyers, she called him an icon. You know, it's no problem for Democrats to focus on allegations against President Trump or Roy Moore. How do you think Democrats should respond to similar allegations against Senator Al Franken or Congressman Conyers?
I've been very blunt. I find all of these allegations, period, despicable, disturbing. And unfortunately, I know that this has happened to women throughout my work life. But I also know that there are times when false allegations are made. And that's why I'm being very careful, because we still are a country where you are innocent until proven guilty. But we also, for too long, you and I both remember Anita Hill. Mm-hmm. And Anita Hill, his reputation was destroyed. And four other women came forward. And everybody thought that that was going to be a watershed moment. And it wasn't. And men and women, this isn't something that women can do. Men and women together need to have a conversation about what is offensive, what is acceptable. Assault is never acceptable. Showing your naked body. None of these things are acceptable. But then there are more complicated discussions that make everybody feel uncomfortable. I hate having this conversation, but I want it to be real. And because I do know that it isn't going to really be real for too many women, I am navigating it very carefully, because that kind of behavior on any male's part is never okay. a woman should never feel uncomfortable, and yet there are other sides to the story. And we got to be able to have real conversations.
When you hear the accused calling and being called an icon, I mean, gee, you know, so was Harvey Weinstein, was a icon in Hollywood. So was Roman Polanski. You know, isn't that more business as usual than calling him an icon, that it tilts the benefit of the doubt to the man who's accused rather than the accuser?
I think that was the word she chose to use. It is not a word that I would have used. But I've been very blunt about how these allegations are despicable and deplorable and must be investigated quickly.
Well, thinking of aides and staffers and interns on the Hill, as you know, Congress is getting criticism from both sides of the aisle for the secretive way it handles claims of harassment and abusive behavior. That critics say it's a system completely set up to protect the harasser. What do you think, and how would you like to see that complaint process worked over?
I have been very blunt about this. I did not know about the secret fund that was spoken about at the House Administration Committee probably 2 weeks ago now. I think most of my colleagues did not know about it. I do not think taxpayer money should ever be used to hide somebody's inexcusable behavior. I think all of that needs to be open and transparent, and taxpayer money should never be used.
And do taxpayers deserve to know which lawmakers have paid settlements?
I do think that they do, but I will say that I also know, and I know that there are consequences for survivors if their name becomes public. So I want to be very careful that there may be people that do not want some kind of something made public because of potential harm to themselves. So I want to protect the survivors. But I think we need to begin to make immediate changes. And I hope when we go back tomorrow, that is going to be on the agenda for this week in the House. It must be. But I also think that we've got to stop doing this in the private sector, that for too many companies, they sign these kind of confidentiality agreements too, and that we need to put a window on all of this kind of behavior so people understand what the issues are.
Michigan Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The state of Michigan has a message for Canadian energy giant Enbridge.
Business as usual is no longer acceptable.
That's Valerie Brader, head of the Michigan Agency for Energy, talking about a new legal agreement announced today between Michigan and Enbridge concerning Line 5, those underwater oil pipelines that run under the Straits of Mackinac and the St. Clair River. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here now. Rick, what is Enbridge saying it will do about that part of Line 5? First, let's talk about the part under the St. Clair River.
Right. They're saying that this is actually something that they can accomplish without too much difficulty. And so what they're going to do is they're going to replace the line that runs on the riverbed with a line that's actually buried beneath the river in a tunnel. And then furthermore, it calls for Enbridge to do a study on the portion of Line 5 that runs beneath another body of water, the Straits of Mackinac, to see if similar treatment, it wouldn't be exactly the same, they'd have to figure out what works, whether similar treatment would work there. And it's probably worth pointing out that, you know, the 500 plus miles of pipeline in the state cross hundreds of rivers and streams and ponds and whatnot. And the state is saying that we're taking protection of those just as seriously as we're going to take protection of the Straits of Mackinac.
Does saying, okay, we'll do a study mean, yes, there will eventually be a tunnel under the straits?
No, it does not. They don't know that this is something that's doable. And so the first step is to just look at it and say, is this even something that can be accomplished? They're looking at a few different ideas, maybe tunneling beneath the straits, maybe doing it via some sort of directional drilling mechanism. But no, there is no guarantee that the pipeline under the straits would be encapsulated in a tunnel.
What about strengthening safety measures and monitoring of Line 5?
Well, the state is saying, you know, we're talking about what Enbridge is going to do. The state is saying that they're going to become more engaged in that, that they want to test out some different monitoring ideas, maybe underwater TV cameras in the straits. And they're going to have state employees who are going to be basically partnering with Enbridge to keep an eye on things, in part just to make sure that the communication miscues don't occur again. That a lot of what's happened here is there was information that was within the four corners of the company, but the company, even though they shared it with federal regulators, never shared it with the state. And so they're trying to make sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Did Enbridge basically kind of admit to, yeah, we could have done better?
Enbridge is acknowledging that they have lost the confidence of the public and that this is not going to be fixed overnight. And having a legal agreement with some firm deadlines that could land them in court if they don't meet them, they hope will at least go partway in restoring some measure of public confidence that the line is being safely operated.
And what kind of timetable are we looking at, Rick?
You know what? There are a whole bunch of deadlines about when the St. Clair River portion of this is supposed to be done, when the studies are supposed to be completed, various alternative studies are supposed to be completed. But it all sort of culminates in mid-August of 2018 when the state and Enbridge will either have an agreement on how the pipeline is going to be operated, or the state is going to pursue its own avenues. And Val Brader, the energy director that you acknowledged at the top of this, has said that shutting down the pipeline is still on the table.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. Rick, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
In full disclosure, Enbridge Energy is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
The Accelerate Michigan Innovation Competition announced its list of winners earlier this month, and it is time for us to meet one of them. Christina York is the CEO of Spellbound, which won the People's Choice Award. What her company produces is called augmented reality therapy. What that translates into is a therapy that can help kids who undergo extensive medical treatments to be more comfortable and less fearful. Christina York, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
So briefly, tell us about your company, about how big it is and how long you've been around.
Well, we are a Michigan-based early-stage startup. We're based in Ann Arbor. There's a handful of employees, and we really work on using that cutting-edge technology that's really immersive, which is augmented reality. If anyone's heard of Pokemon Go, it's the idea of putting digital experiences on top of the real world so that they can be experienced at the same time. We use that technology to get kids to cooperate with medical treatment in a way that doesn't cause them trauma.
Wow, that is just, there's parents everywhere going, amen. And doctors, I'm sure.
Yes, very much so.
Does this require special equipment, like the kinds of things we associate with virtual reality, like goggles and the like?
No, it doesn't. And that's, you know, we've spent a lot of time understanding what it's like to be a clinician in the hospital. And as well, as a parent, I understand my children have undergone hospitalization. So it's the idea that we use the devices people already own and that they're comforting and safe to use. So mobile devices, smartphones, tablets. Most therapists in the hospital are assigned a pad. So those exist. And most homes in the U.S. have a smartphone.
So what would a kid experience using this program? Let's say youngsters, in the hospital, it's for using in the hospital?
Absolutely. So the hospitals purchase it to use. It's just one of the tools in the toolkit for these certified therapists called child life specialists. And it's their job to get kids to understand in an age-appropriate way what's going to happen to them. They're the ones that are going to be absolutely honest with the child, give them all the information they need, answer all their questions, and be their best friend while they're in the hospital. We create tools for them to use. And the idea is it can be anything from a simple blood draw, you know, a child with a needle phobia or trust issues with healthcare providers, just to get them through that. The story I like to tell is my child, as a toddler, did what most toddlers do and jammed something in her ear. What should have been a quick trip to the urgent care center to flush it out turned into a 16-hour ordeal in the ER where they had to put her under general anesthesia in the operating room just to remove a tree bud from her ear. And the idea was that she didn't cooperate because she was afraid and because she was in pain. And so by diverting attention, this is actually called distraction therapy, diverting their attention, it is known to reduce pain perception by up to a third. The idea is give them something completely immersive, a 3D imaginary world they can participate in, and it allows the clinicians to get their job done efficiently and effectively.
And what are they seeing?
So we often give anything from a playing card-shaped card, postcard shape, or a children's book. And you can hold the mobile device over it. We use the camera on the mobile device to recognize images and text. And once it recognizes what it's looking at, it creates a 3D digital world on top of that. This can be interacted with, you know, the child can touch it or make gestures in front of the phone camera or can touch the screen on the phone. And it really gives them an opportunity for imaginative play in a place where that's not inherent. It also has other features in it. The children just think they're playing. So it works for distraction therapy, but it also works for fine motor skill development. So you imagine physical or occupational therapy, something a lot of kids after procedures or with long-term conditions have to go through, and it's repetitive, boring, frustrating, and often painful. So it's not something they want to participate in. And when they don't participate, it takes longer to heal. The idea is get them having fun in this imaginative world. It reduces their perception of pain, and it actually gets them to do the movements that are good for them to get them home quicker.
You know, you mentioned Pokemon Go, very much like that. We're used to seeing people walk around parks and around streets playing Pokemon Go. What are they seeing? Is there a Star Wars version? Is there a, I mean, what is it?
I'll explain a couple of our popular products. The one is these simple little, they're 1-inch by 1-inch cards that can be held in the palm of a child's hand, and they have a single animal on them. Whether they sit it on a table or hold it in their hand, when they put the device in front of it, that animal comes to 3D life, and they can interact with it. It can move. It can hear sounds. We have a whole series of them, and you can put the animals together and watch the animals interact. So you can create a little virtual play world. And then we have other cards where it's a whole scenario, like one's a medieval castle scenario where you can interact with the castle, plant farmers' fields, do a joust. It creates a mini imaginative world that they can interact with, really immerse themselves in, divert attention, as well as develop motor skills.
That's fascinating. What brought you into this world of medical therapy?
I have been in technology for about 17 years. I've worked primarily in higher ed as well as in hospitals before. I kind of understood that. I decided I wanted to venture out on my own and actually started with an education app. The technology we work with is super immersive. We believe it has the ability to improve kids' understanding of content. And so we thought, let's improve pleasure reading. Let's get kids re-engaging with paper books again at a young age. And that was a great idea. It just didn't really take off. At some point, we were interviewing a lot of parents about their habits with technology and their children. And one of the parents happened to be one of these therapists in a hospital and said to us, I need this for my work. And I had never heard of the job title of child life specialist before. So I spent a lot of time understanding that. And C.S. Mott at the University of Michigan was the first children's hospital that really is an early adopter of a lot of this advanced technology for augmented as well as virtual reality. And they use it with patients all the time. So they helped us learn from the clinician's perspective why it's so important to get kids in a non-traumatic way to cooperate with the treatment.
What are your plans? Are you planning to go to hospitals throughout Michigan and elsewhere?
Yes, we're currently in 16 hospitals across the country. So we just started this year selling to hospitals. University of Michigan was our first, but we have hospitals in California and New York and Texas, all over the country. So we're creating more tools for these therapists to use, some tools specifically directed toward physical therapists because they have bigger movements. So our next big thing is about transforming spaces. If you think about a child who has, say, a congenital heart defect, where they have to go into the hospital, have a surgery, and then live in the hospital while their heart grows between surgeries, these children can be living for months and months and months in a hospital. And if you've been in a hospital, you know what those rooms look like. Even a children's hospital, which may be beautifully decorated, it doesn't change this tiny little room. We can put a wall decal, a simple like removable sticker on the wall that when they point the device at it, suddenly their room is an undersea world or an outer space adventure. You know, we've talked to even teenagers who have to maybe live in the hospital quite frequently. And the thing they say they miss the most is the stars at night. So they can lay in their bed and point the device up at the ceiling and see the nighttime sky. So it's this idea of also giving them moments of escape and joy while they're in the hospital to help them with their healing.
Christina York, CEO of Spellbound, winner of the People's Choice Award in the 2017 Accelerate Michigan competition with a therapeutic tool helping children cope with medical treatment. Thanks for sharing your work with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. So Michigan State took that horrendous 3-9 record from last season and flipped it right over, ending the season 9-3 with that win over Rutgers and ranked at 19th.
How about them Spartans, by the way? And play the tape, man. We actually called this more or less. I think I called 8 wins, you and I did. Mm-hmm. And there they are. And our reasoning was, everyone's claiming gloom and doom and D'Antonio's gone and he's lost. And blah, blah, blah. No, he hasn't. No one forgets how to coach at age 60. This does not happen. So he got back to fundamentals. This is not a fancy Michigan State team. It's not a great Michigan State team. It is a fundamentally sound Michigan State team. That's all he had to do to get 9 wins, pretty much.
And you're thinking about this as a young team with 2 seniors, 2 juniors, 6 sophomores, and a freshman. So what do you think these kids can do in future years?
I think they will be competing again for a Big Ten title next year. Imagine that.
In 2 years, from the depths
exactly,
to that.
Which is why, again, what college football fans bring is passion, which I love. Mm. What they usually do not bring is patience and perspective. So when your team wins, you're the best team of all time. No, you're not. You're going to lose next weekend. And when you lose, you'll never win another game. So,
well, let's talk about Michigan now. We'll sidle
Speaking
over there.
Speaking of patience and perspective and passion.
Wrapping up the season at 8-4 after that loss to Ohio State, unranked in the national standings and blowing that 14-point lead, falling to an Ohio State team being led by the backup quarterback.
The backup, actually.
Yeah, that's right. The backup.
And there's the problem, honestly. John O'Korn, God bless me, has got tears in his eyes after the game, so choked up. And
got to say, as a mom, that was hard to watch.
Oh, absolutely. As a fan, as a human being, mm-hmm. hopefully it's hard to watch.
Yes.
Not everyone on Twitter agrees with us, of course, but so what? But that was the difference this game. The defense played great. The offense played, by and large, pretty well. A great game plan by the coaches, which they did not have, I've argued, against Michigan State earlier. Mm-hmm. That's the one loss out of the four that I thought was, if not inexcusable, something close to it. It was a very poorly coached and played game. But there they are at 8-4. I call them 10-2, but when you're in your third quarterback, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Harbaugh has not yet built his machine up the way he needs it. He'll need, again, 4 or 5 years. That's what it takes to get your recruits in and do your job.
And then when late Sunday, we hear Wilton Spate is heading elsewhere. Destination unknown. Did you see this coming?
I did not. And I'm surprised by it. I don't know any of my sources who saw it coming, my reporter sources, that is. Mm-hmm. Clearly, he must have gotten the message, directly or indirectly, that he is not going to be the starting quarterback next year, that it must be Brandon Peters' team now, who was the backup originally, and now he's the first stringer. So there you have it. And that was surprising to me, but these things do happen.
So, you know, fans want to see these big rivalries, you know, Ohio State and Michigan State, and Jim Harbaugh is getting a mega paycheck for that. Yet in these 6 games against the Spartans and Buckeyes, he's won exactly 1 game against last year's terrible MSU team. ESPN noted Harbaugh joins Rich Rodriguez as the only Michigan coaches to lose their first 3 games against Ohio State. So how much of all of this is on him and his well-compensated coaching staff?
At the end of the day, all of it. I mean, you're the head coach. This is your program, and I'm sure Harbaugh said the same thing, that it's your ship, man. The flip side is, again, patience and perspective. This program is clearly going the right direction. Short memories. 3 years ago, people were about as miserable as I've ever seen them in Ann Arbor about football. It was raining. It was cold. You're 5-7. You're losing to Maryland, for crying out loud, and you're going nowhere. The AD's been fired, and the coach is about to be fired. So everything here is structurally sound. Now, fans don't want to hear that always, but they will get there.
They will get there. You got to ask, is Michigan-Ohio State really a rivalry? When you consider the last 14 meetups between OSU and Michigan, Michigan has now lost 6 straight, and they lost 13 of those last 14 games. You compare that maybe to the, you know, what we saw Saturday when Auburn stunned #1 Alabama. That is a rivalry for the ages.
I would say on paper, you're right, of course. The flip side is, about half those games have been very close when they probably should not have been, because in a rivalry game, Michigan will pick it up, and they almost have beaten them 4 or 5 times this year, last year, etc. The other thing, too, is that Auburn, Alabama, they're both in the same state, and culturally they're about the same. Mm-hmm. Michigan, Ohio State, sorry, they're not. It's a state rivalry, of course, and that runs deeper, I think, than other ones.
Got to get your reaction to one of the games in the Michigan High School Football Championships. Clarkston High School knocking off powerhouse West Bloomfield High. They got a bunch of kids going to Division I teams. They won the Division I title by a score of 3-2.
Not hockey, folks.
Yeah.
Football. That means a field goal on one side and what's called a safety on their side. 2 points is what you get for stopping the other team in their own end zone. So The defense scored all the points, I guess, ultimately. Those, to me, are two extremely well-coached teams, because when your defense is playing that well in a big game, that is discipline. That is coming after it every single play. Look, on offense, to score a touchdown, all you need is two guys to do something really cool, maybe one guy. On defense, all 11 guys have to do the exact right thing to stop them. If one guy out of 11 screws it up, they score. And they didn't. So those hats off to both teams. I'm sure Wes Bloomfield is bummed out, no doubt. Great coach, former Michigan player, by the way. But that is a serious football game.
And finally, anything you want to say about the Lions' loss to the Vikings on Thanksgiving Day?
Not much.
Playoff picture?
Grim. And it's gotten grimmer, because I thought they were going to beat Vikings at home. They beat them on the road. Now on the wild card, by the way, the wild card is no bargain this time around in the National Conference, which is where Detroit plays. So they are not guaranteed much here. They've got to almost win out. They really do.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The long-held image of a teacher standing in front of a classroom holding a piece of chalk or a dry erase marker has to die. So says our next guest. Matinga Ragatz was Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011. Earlier this year, she was inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame. And these days, as a consultant, she works to help teachers innovate and rethink their roles in the classroom. At our recent live show in East Lansing, I spoke with Matinga Ragatz, and here's our conversation.
So, Matinga, let's jump right in. Why do you think today's teaching style is archaic and needs to be overhauled?
Well, it's pretty obvious, you know, and I'm so glad that we have the mayor speaking at the beginning of the hour, because he talked about economic development. And schools are the seeds of economic development. And if teachers were to think about their job as economic development, and if the community were to think of schools as the place where economic development starts, you know that chalk and or whiteboard and marker is not the place to be. Also, I think it's very important for us to remember that the traditional methods are very much of a follow the leader type of format. And the world that we're preparing the students to go into is definitely a self-directed world. So if we're indeed in the business of preparing students for their future, it's so important that we get out of the way and teach them from the very first minute that they're in our care to be very, very much self-directed. And I know that the methods that we worked for, or the traditional methods worked for the traditional environment, the traditional world. But today, in the internet-connected world, in the globally connected world, it's very important that kids have self-direction, kids know how to self-pace, and kids know how to think independently and think specifically on where they're getting their information, what their information looks like, what is the background behind the information. So now this sit and get method that we have in the traditional method is just no longer good enough for the 21st century learner.
So instead of the sit, I love that sit and get, because we all went through that.
Yeah.
You sat and you took notes and you got. So instead of the whiteboard or the chalkboard, mm-hmm. Nobody clapping erasers after school, I guess, what would you have instead?
Well, the first thing, the one question that students always ask is why. In education, we rarely ask why. So if those of you who are familiar with the Simon Sinek model of, you know, start with the why, then the how, and then the what. In education, we always start with the what. What teacher? What book? What curriculum? But we never answer the one question that the kids always want to know. It's why? Why do I have to know this? Why are you here? Why am I here at 8 o'clock in the morning? But, you know, so we always start with the why. Today, the kids are, they're used to an on-demand world. They're used to a world where when they click, they get their why, they get their answer to why. I can tell you this much. What's happening right now is kids dumb down the minute they enter the threshold of our classrooms. Is the only place where they get the idea to put their hands up. Because I know that my kids play video games, and I've never, like never, had my kids ask me, Mom, how do you make Mario jump up and down? You don't. And those of you who have kids, you know you've never had that question. But the minute you walk into the classroom, there's a habitual way of, oh, I don't have to think. Somebody's have to do the thinking for me. I just have to follow and do exactly as the teacher tells me.
So you can just see them dialing it right.
100%. And today we keep talking about the kids being, you know, they're not engaged. They're always looking at their screens and they're not always playing video games. And that's the one place in the world where nobody tells them what to do.
Interesting. And you say that you have seen too many kids leave school and then have a hard time figuring out what to do and where to land. Why do you think this is?
Again, because we don't train them in that piece. So if you start with the question of why, the first thing that thinks of is these skills. So nowadays, kids can pretty much Google everything that the teacher says to them. So it's very important that we start talking about the skills. Economic development requires skills. And for a student to go 12 years of education, then add college, then add grad school, for them to leave the educational system and then be told, sorry, you don't have enough experience, that's like a suable offense. You know, it angers me. So students, when they leave our care, should have 12 years of experience, and they should have this amazing resume of things they've done, people they've talked to, things they've done with their hands. And I'm so glad that you had creative people on their show, people who do things purposefully. Kids are just like short, but they're just people. They want a life of purpose. They want to live everywhere, every day with purpose. And the saddest thing that kids do today, is when you tell them, hey, how was school? It was school. What a waste. What a waste of 12 years.
And so you talk about real world and project-based learning experiences that could be wonderful for both students and teachers, such as?
For instance, and you imagine this. You've seen it. We have, for example, high schools with kids 14 and up. They're at their strongest physically. They can see better than us. They can think quicker than us. But what are they doing? But drooling in the back of somebody's classroom. Instead, why aren't they participating in the economic development of their communities? Why aren't they participating in building things in their communities? Kids who build things in their communities will not participate in the destruction of that community. So it's very, very important that we take our curriculums, which are great, and we look at the curriculum not as a checklist, but as a roadmap. Yep, this is where we go. But if something happens in the community or something happens in the world, we really need to turn the students' head towards that and help them appreciate that and also be discerning consumers of media, discerning consumers of the curriculum that they're learning as well.
And what about for the teachers, if they can be in part of that and put down the piece of chalk?
100%. And as teachers, we need to not remove our community member hat when we walk into the classroom. We are all passionate. We go into the profession because we want to make a difference. But then we get caught up in policy. We get caught up in rules. I don't know if you've heard I don't know if you've listened to the radio lately, Cynthia. But there's this thing that we are doing as a community. Every time there's something happens in the world, oh, well, teachers ought to do this. Well, teachers have to do that. And teachers had to do this. How about if you just have the kids do it? Right? Have them role play. Not role play as in theater, but have them practice how it is to live in the world, to live in the 21st century for real, as opposed to having them just sit in school. So teachers, don't take your community member hat, your passions away from schools. Instead, take them into the schools and infect your students with it.
Matinga, what do you think is lost when there's so much focus on test scores and evaluations for the student and for the teacher?
Time. Every minute a student is in my classroom is a minute I can now take back. So if I spend 55 minutes wasting his time preparing for a test that will never matter, and because the test, we all know, we can all agree that the tests test how well you test. And we're competing against countries that teach kids how to take tests. So now if we want to play that game, we can. But, as an immigrant my own self, I know that this is a country of innovation. We are here to innovate, not to copy. So if we are, concentrating so much on the test, we're wasting time, we're wasting valuable resources, and we're wasting that moment that every one of our students need from us.
So without that, how do you measure whether a teacher is effective and whether a student is learning?
Well, I think there should be tests. but we should use the test more responsibly. So tests are not to beat the Canadians or beat the Chinese. I mean, it's like, that's what, you know, use a stick for that. But, you know, but tests should be, you know, just use it as it was meant, as a measure, as to, like, it's almost like a formative measurement. This is where we should be, rather than as a punitive instrument.
All right, now, I imagine that as you preach this gospel that you're very passionate about, you're going to encounter people that say, hey, I went through school cracking a textbook and taking notes from the teacher standing at the front of the classroom, and I turned out all right, and I'm having a good life. And by the way, if these kids go on to college or graduate school, there will be somebody up at the front of the classroom, you know, doing a lecture. And what if they're not ready for that because of the self-directed learning techniques? What do you say to that?
Well, a self-directed learner is a Renaissance person. So they can sit through a lecture and ask the tough questions rather than drooling. A self-directed learner has the experience to and the life experience to actually internalize the material and internalize the content and make the connections rather than just take the notes and spit it out.
In your vision, what might a school, if you could wave a magic wand and have the kind of school and the kind of classrooms and instruction that you're preaching about, what would it look like?
First of all, I would eliminate the bell. Remember that bell? Eliminate the school bell. I would eliminate also this.
How would you get to second period history?
You just wouldn't. You just would. Especially, you know, you're 14 years old. In other countries, you're the head of a family. And here in our Western countries, we just feel like, oh, no, they're too deaf. They can't even cross the road, that kind of thing, right? And so I'd eliminate the bell, and the kids would have a specific, like a long-term research that they're doing, almost like a mini dissertation that they're working through with 4 years. And they come in, and instead of siloing every subject, they have these, multiple subjects that they can relate to based on their passion. So you come to class, you get your cup of coffee, you hang out at the cafeteria, and then you look at the board, and you're like, oh, you know what? There's a thesis statement workshop that I'd like to attend because my thesis statement stinks. Okay, we'll see you guys. I'm going to go to the thesis statement workshop that the teacher is putting out. And I'll look at the board and going, yeah, I should look at my conclusion as well. And go there and do it because you need it right now, not someday. You will need to know this in an age of on-demand. Kids today don't understand that someday where you can get it today.
What do you think is holding Michigan schools back from rethinking and experimenting with the teacher's role in the classroom?
Ah, too many cooks in the kitchen. You know, I think they should just let teachers teach. I would love to bring the teach back into teacher. I feel that teachers are professionals. They understand, they're experts in how students learn, yet we always have outside hands telling us, no, they learn by following this particular guideline. No, and it's always a person who wrote a book or somebody who got elected that tells us how to run the classrooms. Just because we all went to the to school doesn't make us experts in education. Just because we were all teenagers doesn't mean we are experts on being teenagers in the 21st century. No, we don't. Because the distractions and the pressures that they have is completely different. So we have to completely change. We have to change learning like a store changes fashion. So every year, a new set of learning ideas need to be in process so that every group of students finds fresh ideas rather than the stale, old chalk and board idea that we've been selling.
What do you love about your work now teaching teachers?
Oh, my gosh. Teaching teachers is the hardest job I've ever done, but it's all because teachers, we are like that. But it's also the most rewarding. Rewarding because I'm reminded every day that I am observing a teacher or I am talking to a group of teachers how difficult the work is and how committed the Michigan teachers are. And I'm also reminded every single time I'm there of just the progress that we're making as a profession as well. I feel like if let loose, we as teachers would really have an impact on the economic development of our state. If let loose, because, you know, we command 30 kids, right? And so we have, and when you're teaching teachers, of course, you're not only impacting 30 kids in their classroom, you're now impacting hundreds of classrooms and hundreds of kids as well. So it's just a dream job.
And what do you think when you see teachers flee the profession?
Ooh, there is a national crisis. We are really in trouble. Even teachers don't want their kids to be teachers. However, I feel that if teachers can stand up and stand on the side of the students and work to innovate our profession, we will bring the kids back. So it's very, very disheartening that people don't want to teach, but it's very, very understandable. The profession itself has not evolved, so we are still being taught. We're still being taught the same way. Educational institutions are still working the same way. We are still being paid the same way. The expectations are the same, even though our clientele is completely different. We got kids in the back of the class who are taking quantum physics from a MOOC in Stanford. There's kids who have businesses and they're making more money than their teachers. Yet we just kind of sit here and go through this theater of, okay, turn to page 8 and I'm going to read to you. So imagine that.
Talk to the young person who is kind of at that crossroads and trying to decide where their life's direction will be. What is your sales pitch for being a teacher?
Wow, if you want a sexy job, if you want a job where not one single day will be the same, and if you want a job that you can job craft, and this is the best part of teaching. So if you choose the marker and the whiteboard and your lesson plans, it's purely your own option. But if you choose to, it's almost like the Miss Frizzle bus, right? Remember Miss Frizzle? It's the Miss Frizzle bus. Because in this job, and I know because I've done it, you can travel. You can meet interesting people. Nobody ever says no when you ask them to come to your classroom, especially if it's digitally, to come to your classroom and talk to your kids. Nobody ever says no. So mayors, governors, everybody comes into your classroom. It's really an interesting job, but it's also an option. So if you want to go the straight and narrow, go ahead. But if you want to be someone who is going to touch young lives and really change lives, and tell you what, as a teacher, right, you want to be that person where that the students are going to look up and go, wow, I want to be that person. I want to be that person because look at how cool their life is, rather than, when they get all shocked because they see you in the grocery store. What are you doing here?
You have a real life.
Like, you don't live in the classroom? I thought you lived in my cubby.
Listen, I had nuns. It was even weirder if you saw
right. I had nuns too. Oh, we have to share stories.
We will share war stories.
Oh my gosh.
I can completely understand. I bet kids were falling over themselves to take your classes at Grand Ledge High School.
We had a lot of fun. Yeah, it was just a lot of fun.
And it's very clear why you were Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011 and in the National Teachers Hall of Fame. Matenga Ragatz, what a pleasure.
I know we'll be talking again. Cynthia, I adore you. I'm ready to have a love fest right now. I just adore you. And I'm just surrounded by all these Michigan radio people. Really, love fest.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you very much.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
And one note before we go. Last week, we featured a conversation about Eastern Michigan University's decision to hire a company to help market and deliver online courses. In the introduction, we mentioned Michigan Technological University had a similar arrangement. MTU reached out to us and told us it only contracts with an outside company to provide an online platform for students and professors to communicate. While a spokesperson says they've received a number of overtures from companies to do more, Michigan Tech has not entered into any partnership agreement to market and assist with its online courses. We regret the misunderstanding. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.